Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 107 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host as usual. And today I have a delightful guest, Kathleen or Kat Hyland, who is a practicing solo attorney here in the state of Maryland. And interestingly, she practices in an area that we haven't had a lot of exposure to here on the podcast, and that's consumer rights law. And we're going to talk about things like student loan debt and debt collection and phone harassment and mortgage foreclosure and other consumer right issues and how that affects her practice and how she developed such an interesting and to some extent niche focus to her practice areas. And in addition to that, she's also an adjunct professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law here at the University of Maryland, and teaches in the law practice management space, which if you've been a listener to this podcast, you know is an area that I think the law schools pay not nearly enough attention to. So I'm delighted that my undergraduate alma mater, University of Maryland, is one of those schools that does focus on at least offering some level of instruction in law practice management. And Kat is one of the instructors who teaches that class. And we'll spend a few minutes talking about that as well. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kat Hyland. Kathleen Hyland, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm delighted that you could be here. Kat, I understand that you go by the name Kat. Is that okay to refer to you as Kat?
That would be great.
Awesome. So, Kat, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. Well, I am a consumer protection attorney based in Baltimore City. I practice statewide. I originally moved to Baltimore 13 years ago to pursue a master's in public policy. And from that, went on to work for the Maryland state government for a few years as a budget policy analyst. Realized I was really drawn to the practice of law, working on legislation, and wasn't sure where it would take me. Through this, I studied with Peter Holland, who was teaching consumer protection at the time, and is also a practicing Maryland attorney. Fell in love with that practice area, and through a couple of different avenues, went to work at a nonprofit doing consumer protection issues, then a private firm, and then opened my own practice in May of 2016.
Terrific. And how is private practice solo life treating you?
It's great. It's an exciting adventure. So I really love the predictability and the unpredictability, being a small business owner, determining my schedule and my portfolio of cases, and then just learning constantly as I go how to perfect my craft of litigation.
When you were in law school or when you were practicing, with a mentor, did you always envision yourself at some point being a solo, or what drew you to the solo life?
Well, it was in my mind because when I was in law school, when I graduated, we all knew the market wasn't very good. So I had a degree of self-determination. I knew I wanted to become proficient in litigation, find a passion, and also land on my feet. You know, I have real responsibilities. I'm a homeowner in Baltimore City. I had student debt and just wanted to make sure I had a plan for myself. So if there wasn't going to be a plan provided by the market, I was going to create that plan. But then I had the fortunate experience of first working at Civil Justice, which is a small nonprofit in Baltimore City that supports small and solo firms and provides resources, referrals, and some additional CLEs, et cetera. And so while working there, I learned what it could be like to be a solo practitioner and use some of those resources. Then when I left that nonprofit in order to pursue this path, one of my other mentors, Jane Santoni, took me in at her firm as of counsel. So I sort of staircased into what then became my solo practice.
Interesting.
So it became more of a path and more of a reality as I got more comfortable practicing law and then saw how other people were doing it.
Yeah, so it looked like it was on the horizon, and that horizon was out there a little bit when you started, but each step along the way, that horizon became a little closer for you and a little more of a reality.
Exactly. And then also my practice area that I ended up falling in love with or am really engaged in so far in my career doesn't have many big law firms in Maryland. So it was almost a function of the practice area that I picked too.
Well, that, you know, is a great segue into the questions I wanted to ask you about your practice area, because of all the solo and small firm practitioners that we've had on here on the Law Entrepreneur, I don't think we've had a consumer rights advocate, consumer rights law focused on by any attorney who's been on thus far. And it's interesting because there's so many aspects of what you practice that are really pertinent to attorneys and solo practitioners. So let's dive into that just a little bit, because I think it would benefit all those who are listening here. I mean, one of the biggest problems that we as attorneys have, and particularly solo practitioners, is, as you have said, the burden of that student loan debt. Mm-hmm, and all right. The issues that go along with that. So what are some of those issues that are faced by people with, you know, that crushing debt and you know, the tangential issues that go along with student loans?
Well, the biggest issue that I see, which affects all of the people coping with student loan debt, is dealing with whether or not it's going to be a barrier to accessing other forms of credit.
Yeah.
There tends to be a sense or a misguided judgment that people facing debt can't afford to make other financial decisions. And that's not so based on this particular category of student debt. Student debt affects many people in different parts of the society and not just a lower income segment, which, you know, other forms of debt may more directly relate to. So I work with many clients who are trying to buy their first house, trying to access other credit, trying to go back to school for an additional graduate degree, who didn't expect a situation with their student loans to be a problem. So one of the things that I work on is helping them both plan for repayment of existing student loans and then get out of default.
Well, one of the things that I see from my previous life in a business marketplace are folks who have taken out loans to go to, let's say, a non-traditional educational institute. Uh-huh. They're going to a tech company for training in, let's say, you know, web development or like a trade school.
Right, like a for-profit trade school.
Yeah, for-profit trade school. And those seem to be some of the more burdensome situations. Are you saying the same thing, or is it just my narrow view of the world?
Well, yeah, and actually, one of my roles outside of my practice is to serve as the vice president on the board of directors of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition. They actually released a report. It was a breakthrough report, the first one in the nation, called Making the Grade, and it was an evaluation of for-profit students in Maryland compared to nationally. And they produced a lot of statistics on how troublesome that very issue is. The types of tuition programs that these students are enrolled in, the cost of education, and the student loan debt that is accumulated by some of the for-profit schools.
Yeah.
So as a reaction to that in Maryland about 2 years ago, we advocated for and got legislation passed that limits the extent to which for-profit schools can knowingly sign up students who aren't qualified for the programs and makes any abuses of the marketing an unfair and deceptive trade practice under our Maryland Consumer Protection Act.
And where I see it is, and again, it's just anecdotally, is it's usually the parents or grandparents who've co-signed.
Yes.
It's not usually the actual student who has benefited from or maybe not benefited from the for-profit teaching environment. It's the co-signer who then suddenly finds their phone ringing 2, 3, 5 times a day because somebody's behind on their payment.
Right. I see a lot of that. I see aunts, uncles, grandparents, parents who are borrowing against their 401k or taking out home lines of credit to try to pay down private student loan debt.
Yeah.
And then there is some federal student loan debt that's under the Parent Plus program. They can't co-sign the federal loans, but they can be affected like a co-signer when they have financial obligations to a school they didn't attend.
So student loan debt and the associated issues related to that are obviously something that I see attorneys dealing with all the time,
yes.
Solo practitioners. The other part is debt collection. You know, one of the things that solos face is, you know, how do you, in some cases, they don't know how to collect from clients who haven't paid them. It's an age old problem. And particularly if you go in some of the practice areas that lend themselves most readily to the new practitioner, say family law is an example. Mm-hmm. And I speak from experience. You know, there are times mm-hmm. when the pace of the case outstrips the ability of the client to pay, and pretty soon you have a negative balance.
Right.
And it gets to be a problem. So are you seeing in your debt collection practice area, do you see attorneys coming to you in that space?
No, I actually don't represent people collecting debts. I represent consumers who are having debts collected against them.
Ah, okay.
So it's the other side. I do have colleagues who do that kind of debt collection uh-huh. for attorneys in Maryland, and they have to be very careful to be in compliance with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Maryland statute, the Maryland Consumer Debt Collection Act. Which have guidelines on how you can collect the debts that are very important. But when those guidelines are violated by debt collectors across the board, especially those who are purchasing debt and collecting it without having a previous relationship with consumers, a lot of things happen. You know, abusive phone calls, letters that are written incorrectly, false and misleading information, collection of debts that are no longer collectible. And those are the types of issues that I work on.
That you deal with. Yeah.
Right. In addition to delving into the credit contracts that originated the debt and looking at whether or not that complies with the Maryland commercial law.
Well, then talk a little bit about, you know, phone harassment, because that is a component, I think, of all of these things, student loan right. debt and debt collection and some of the other things. I see people again, just anecdotally now, who are disconnecting their landlines.
Yes,
in part because of phone harassment, and in many cases, harassment associated with debt collection.
It's a real thing, and I see it a lot. And what consumers need to know that they don't know before they often or don't often know before they meet with me is that they can request that the creditor stop calling them and send them a written request saying, I revoke any consent I gave you when I signed a contract and gave you my phone number to now call me for the debt. And while this may escalate the issue and take it into litigation where they can put an attorney between them and the debt collector, it can relieve the consumer of the aggressive phone calls because it's a real thing. Companies are using devices called auto dialers right. to make robocalls, and they'll hammer cell phones in particular over and over again, and sometimes mistakenly call employers, which can really run the risk of great embarrassment to someone who's dealing with a debt issue.
Yeah, and one of the things I just saw covered in the news, and I've seen it myself personally, is some of these robocallers now are spoofing the phone numbers, the originating mm-hmm. phone numbers, so that they carry the same area code and three-digit yeah. prefix. So it looks like a number coming from your neighborhood or maybe from a family member who has the same starting, you know, six digits yes. in their phone number. And then you pick it up and find out, no, it's a debt collector.
Right. And I actually get some of those calls too to my cell phone yep. just from signing up for marketing products. Yep. When I launched my law firm, you know, I get them for people wanting to sell me websites or other forms of technology.
For sure.
You're exactly right. I still have on my cell phone only a Long Island area code because that's where I moved here from. And so when I see the 516, you know, right. 333 number, I say, that's not anyone I know.
No. It's
one of those people. Well, you're exactly right.
And ironically, it's easier to, and we're getting off on topic here, but it doesn't matter. Ironically, it's easier to block those phone numbers on your cell phone than it is on your landline.
Yes. And I encourage clients to either block them or to pick up and say, please stop calling me, and then make a journal entry of that so that if they continue to be harassed, they've done what they need to do to set the stage.
Yeah. The mantra that I have repeated to my family is to answer the phone. I'm not interested. Put me on your do not call list.
Like, yes, that is the correct thing to say. Although my brother in New York answers and says, Vincent's Pizzeria, what can I get you?
Exactly. It's another clever way. So lastly, in terms of your practice area, I just find this interesting because, again, we haven't had somebody on the show that does what you do. Mm. You spend, I suspect, a lot of time in mortgage foreclosure defense. Is that a fair statement?
You know, it was fair for when I began my practice, because at Civil Justice, they had been very well funded to provide direct service for foreclosure defense. Uh-huh. And one of the best attorneys in that field in the state, Philip Robinson, had been working on cases that I took over when he left to open his private practice. So I started that way, but I really found more of a passion for auto fraud and debt collection issues. And then the debt defense, but also credit service business issues where we have unlicensed people providing credit to people in the state. So I morphed into a different direction, although I do have a couple of mortgage cases in my portfolio right now.
Well, this is just for my own edification. Is it still a big problem? I know, 10 years ago in the mortgage crisis, it was a huge problem, foreclosure defense. And so much so that in our state here in Maryland, there were some free training offered if you would sign up to take on pro bono clients in mortgage defense. Is it as big a problem?
It's not as big, but it's still a problem. Okay. And while I don't have any concrete numbers for you, I can say that my friends who have foreclosure defense practices are very busy.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to manage my practice. If you're feeling swamped trying to keep track of cases and clients, but you don't want to pay the hefty price tag of something like Salesforce or other legal-specific tools, I recommend you give Daylight a look. Daylight helps me prioritize my day. It helps me keep track of my clients, cases, documents, emails, calendars, to-dos, and reminders, all in one place. The case management part of Daylight makes it really easy to organize all the details and work for each case so things are done on time. The best part of Daylight is that it lets you work offline. You don't need an internet connection to pull up case details or info about a client like with other CRMs and case management tools. And new in Daylight is their Zapier integration, so you can automate things like pulling new leads from a contact form on your website right into Daylight. And for techies like me, you know that integration with tools like Zapier is really fundamental to making something like Daylight work the way you want it to work. So to learn how Daylight can help you grow your practice, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. And be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first month subscription. That's Daylight by Market Circle. This episode is also brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to keep me top of mind with my referral network. Visit spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur. Spotlightbranding.com/TLE, brought to you by our friends at Spotlight Branding. Well, so having discussed consumer rights law, let's talk about your practice a little bit. So. Sure. Tell us a little bit how you're set up, office space, how you came about it. Did you search for office space? Did you work from the kitchen table? How did you evolve to where you are?
I'm very lucky in that category. When I was looking to open my practice, I called another mentor of mine. Mentors are a real theme to my business model.
So far, I've counted four, I think.
Yeah, and they're all really important people who have helped me along the way. But I called Dave Hoskins, who is another consumer attorney in Maryland, who was assigned, we were assigned to each other when I did Judge Battaglia's mentorship program.
Okay.
I signed up for that as soon as I was sworn in, and I said, I intend to practice consumer law, and they matched me with one in my neighborhood, which was really cool. So Dave and I would meet for coffee in Hamden and go over any cases that I was working on. And he was really generous with his time. And he was also on the board of civil justice at the time. So as I began to handle more cases, he was there as an advisor, which I really owe him a debt of gratitude for. And we have co-counseled too. So I called Dave, who has a beautiful office suite on the corner of Lombard and Light Street in a 4-story renovated brick building. And I asked him if he had any space to lease. And he said, what is your budget? And I told him, and he said, when would you like to move in? And I said, oh my goodness, because this is really great space that I don't know that I would have been able to find on my own just searching the private market. So it really goes to the power of pre-existing relationships and networking. So I'm set up.
So you had a extensive property search to find the the ideal location. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with that location, Lombard and Light Street in downtown Baltimore is about as good as you can get.
Yeah, I can walk to the federal court. I can walk to the circuit court. I can run to the district court for last minute filings. And I can keep suits here so I can be casual and then change right before court if I need to, which I love. But let me tell you a little bit about the office suite because it's really gorgeous. It's a giant square office with conference rooms in the center. So we have 3 conference rooms I can use with all sorts of legal books in them that I don't really open because I'm a Westlaw person. And then we've got our copy scanner, kitchenette area, a bike rack room, and showers. And a gym located across the street, one of those Planet Fitnesses that I should use more, that's $10 a month. So it's really an ideal location. And then directly below me is a printing and office conference room video recording business. So if I need briefs printed or served, or if I need to do a video deposition, I can use the facilities at Benchmark right below me. So it's a great setup. And then the best part is that I was able to expand and bring on a legal assistant shortly after I practiced and use the front area of the office for that. There's another office that I've been offered to expand into should I want to hire an associate, which is in my mind. And then Dave and his team are right there if I have questions about my practice area. And while we practice differently, I just think it's so valuable to have another attorney, especially one with so much experience, nearby to consult with.
And one that you have a strong relationship with, you know.
Exactly, who I trust.
Yeah, you trust. That's invaluable. So you must feel very comforted by that entire setup.
You know, I definitely feel like I hit the lottery when he said I could come work out of here.
No kidding. And that describes your staffing. You have the one administrative assistant now, contemplating an associate at some point.
Yes. And I also have a part-time paralegal who I just brought on a month ago while I decide what kind of staffing changes I'm going to make. I'm not sure if I need an associate or just someone to help with more of the drafting due to our caseload.
Yeah. Have you looked at using, you know, virtual staffing? Or how's your paralegal set up? Do they come in on a part-time basis or they work remotely?
So she comes in and she's using the office next to mine right now on a separate arrangement here, you know, just a separate trial arrangement.
I don't know whether your practice area lends itself to being able to use virtual assistants.
I'm not sure. I'm sure there are ways to bring it in. Like one of the books that I read and while working on my business techniques was 4-Hour Work Week.
Sure.
And I know they're all about that.
Yep.
But I run such a face-to-face practice in general. A lot of the people I meet with are really suffering from some of their debt-related issues that I think there's a lot of need for face-to-face interaction, even just in the in-between zones when I'm getting back to people to let them know their case updates. So I like having people on site, although I'm set up where, for example, when we had a snow day last week, I could operate out of the neighborhood pub, which had good Wi-Fi. That's why we were there.
Well, that's what's going to be my next question. Tell us a little bit about your technology setup. How are you configured?
Sure. It's basic and evolving at this point. I use Dropbox, Clio for my law practice management software, LawPay, and then Westlaw for my legal research, and then Ring Central for my phone system.
Okay.
So firm really can be picked up and relocated if I need to practice somewhere else.
Or if you need to practice from the beach for a little while, you can.
Exactly. As I did last year in Delaware when we were lucky enough to have someone loan us their beach house for a week.
Exactly. So, all right. Well, that sounds wonderful. What do you view in terms of your development as a solo practitioner? What do you view as your best entrepreneurial skill?
I believe my best skill is my networking skill set in general. I am out there on the ground. I'm meeting my colleagues. I'm happy to participate when someone needs me to do a CLE training. I'm happy to lecture at an event, you know, on law practice management. I'm really on the ground and connected to my peers. And it's really important to me to keep in touch with people in my networks, not because they're networking, you know, opportunities, but because my colleagues are important and we see the same things on the ground in the legal and public interest community that affects consumer law. And there's a need to be relevant. So I always want to be part of that conversation. So I spend a lot of time connecting with peers socially and in professional settings to make sure that they know what I'm interested in and I see what issues they are all dealing with. And we also just lend support to one another. We can be helpful and talk about case trends.
Is that your primary business development technique as well?
Well, I mean, it leads to a lot of word of mouth referrals. I haven't done much direct marketing other than having a web presence because I get so many referrals from my colleagues and from public interest organizations. So it's feeding directly back into my business. And that's why I see it as a business development issue.
It absolutely is a business development process. And the people who do the best, obviously. And I would also think for your practice area, because it's the kind of thing that so many other attorneys come across in different ways, that building that referral network of attorneys who know that you practice consumer rights law is important for servicing those referral feeds.
Right. And it works both ways too, because there are a lot of practice areas that my clients deal with that are easy to refer out and often lead to good cases for my colleagues. I mean, my clients get into car accidents and call me because we had a great relationship on their credit card case. They get sick and have a doctor treat them a certain way. They,
their family issues.
They have a lot of family issues. That's what I'm trying to find in my brain. Yeah. They have a lot of family issues. And they also sometimes, you know, have run-ins with the law and need a criminal defense attorney too. So there are a lot of private practice areas that are easy for me to refer to based on how I'm situated. And then a lot of private attorneys who don't really, you know, have the time to take on consumer law. It's not their practice area. So it's been a really good position to be in, being in a smaller practice area in a well-connected community.
Does social media play a role in all this for you?
It does a little bit. I've actually been working on putting together more Facebook advertising posts, and it was the subject of some of my business development ideas last week. There's a lot more that my colleagues are doing that I'm starting to notice that I am researching and intending to roll out within the next 6 months.
Good. Excellent. Well, let's talk also for a few minutes here about your other hat that you wear as an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland Law School, teaching in the law practice management space. How did that come about, first off? And then let's talk about what it is.
Well, first, I'm a graduate of that class. I took it when I was at the University of Maryland School of Law under Chris Floor, who is my co-professor and a criminal defense attorney located in Anne Arundel County, who also practices statewide. And shout out, since we're on a podcast, he represented Adnan in Serial in that podcast. He represented him at his initial bail hearing before the other attorney took over. So Chris's roots go pretty deep in our legal community. And he's just an amazing person, like one of the nicest people I've ever met and have the privilege to call my friend. So Chris is on the board at Civil Justice. And when I started there as associate general counsel right after I graduated from law school, I said, I think it would be cool, being always an opportunist, to provide students who are graduating with a perspective of the market, given that we are in somewhat dismal times, and see how they can make the jump to practice if they end up going into a smaller solo career by bringing my perspective to the market as a, you know, someone new to it, someone going through and plundering and finding my way. And Chris said, I think that's a really great idea. I'll be the seasoned veteran professor and you can be the young person entering the market and you can share with us all of the resources that civil justice has to support small and solo practitioners, like reduced rate Westlaw and CLEs, et cetera, and the referral network. So that's how it started. Chris just basically let me into his class to co-teach with him in 2013. And so we've been co-teaching the class together. I believe this is our fifth year of it. Okay. And each year has gotten more and more developed for us just with the changes in the market and more optimism. And then this year, we've really been rocking it, bringing in these amazing guest speakers from around the country. Had someone from Florida, someone from New Jersey, lots of our Maryland colleagues. So the purpose of the class and how the syllabus is arranged is to provide a toolkit that someone might use to either launch their own practice or think about doing it in the future in their career, maybe 5 or 6 years out, and also how they could contribute to a medium-sized firm with some business development skills.
Well, as we had discussed on our pre-interview call, this is one of the reasons that this podcast exists. One of the base reasons why I wanted to start it, because in my humble opinion, way too few law schools are paying any attention to the law practice management space. And I think just in terms of the whole legal community, it's an area that is underserved. In some areas, it's being addressed by the bar associations.
Yes.
In some areas, it's being addressed by forward-thinking law schools. In some areas, it's being addressed solely by commercial practices, for-profit training, if you will.
Right.
But it's a hodgepodge. And for the young attorney or the emerging solo attorney, it's hard to figure out sometimes where to start. So I'm pleased that the illustrious Francis King Carey School of Law at, again, my alma mater, University of Maryland, undergrad alma mater, University of Maryland. I'm glad they're addressing the issue. Is it part of a larger program, or is it just a one-off class, or where does it fit in the overall curriculum at UM?
It's purely an elective, although we've drawn a lot of information and resources from other the groups that you mentioned around the country, the private, the law schools, the other nonprofit groups. And one of the frameworks that's been more influential that actually came in through civil justice and then was part of a short-term JD Legal Fellowship funded program at the University of Maryland was the model of the legal incubators at the City Universities of New York. So that model made its way down to civil justice, who did 1 year or 2 years of that and got some funding through the University of Maryland. So a lot of people who wanted to open their own practices took the class knowing that everybody was all part of the same community of interest. And then there have been other iterations of that. First, the funding went back to the law school to become a more like a broad and general job placement program, for lack of a better term. And then civil justice got more funding to do their own legal incubator, more focused program. I think it was a year or two ago.
Yeah, the director of that incubator program, Lynette Whitfield, has been a guest on the podcast, and fortunately, is a good friend of mine, being an attorney just up the street and around the corner, literally.
Sure.
So what I would love to see, just kind of kibitzing here, I would love to see law schools have an additional certification, you know, a track that involves more than just one class in law practice management, that has 3, 4, 5, whatever many classes they are, and that in addition to your JD, you also get a certificate that you've done this law practice management track as well. And I think it would go a long way to helping address the problem. But I'm not going to hold my breath that that's going to happen. I keep advocating for it, but
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Like, and there's just so much insecurity that law students are graduating with because of their lack of exposure, as the traditional training models of associate to full-time graduate positions have dried up in the market. You're not getting the on-the-job training that apparently used to be available. And instead, my students are graduating without ever seeing how a motion is filed in court, yeah. what discovery looks like, what a basic fee agreement looks like, what a retainer letter looks like, you know, a client engagement letter, how to amicably break up with clients that you don't want to work with or can't work with due to conflicts. And these are all such crucial skills. We try to provide documents, you know, just some basic forms on each one of these steps within the semester long period of time that we have, but it's way too short and it's way too surface level. There's so much more to learn.
And even more fundamentally, I see graduates who, maybe it's just the nature of where we are in society now. They've never had to manage a checkbook, much less a trust account.
Or file taxes.
Yeah. Or sign a lease. Yes. Or purchase equipment or hire people. There's just so many facets of this that aren't formally addressed. And I don't know where the answer is. It's spread across three different elements, but it's a problem.
I agree.
So anyway, we'll try and solve the world's problems on the next podcast.
Oh, it's my day-to-day, right? trying to solve all the problems.
So Kat, I want to thank you ever so much for taking the time to be with us today. Tell our audience if they want to reach out to you, what's the best way to do so?
Sure. You can email me at kat@lawhyland.com. That's kat@lawhyland.com. Or, you know, if you just have a question about practicing law in Maryland, or you're another Maryland attorney, or you're a related business, I'm happy to chat with you. My line is 410-777-5396.
Terrific. Well, we'll hopefully some of our listeners will take advantage of that. And Kat, I've enjoyed this time that we've spent together, and I look forward to staying in touch with you as we move forward.
Great. Thank you so much for having me as a guest. It's a real honor.
Thank you for being on. Once again, I'd like to thank our friends at Market Circle, the makers of Daylight and Spotlight Branding, for being sponsors of today's podcast. Market Circles, as the makers of Daylight, provide the tool that I use to manage my cases, my clients, my calendar, my to-dos, the emails, and they do so all in one app that stays with me on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. I use Daylight on my own in a solo environment, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases and delegate tasks to one another on your team, and you can see everyone's schedule all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools that I use to stay organized, and it increases my efficiency, and therefore it only stands to reason that it'll do the same for you and your team if you use it in a broader environment. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know that you heard about Daylight through the Law Entrepreneur in order to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. Also, our friends at Spotlight Branding, as always, have been very helpful in sponsoring this podcast. You know, I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to help keep me top of mind with my referral network. So visit www.spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the Law Entrepreneur. So spotlightbranding.com/TLE to access your free gift. And as always, make sure that you visit our website, www.thelawentrepreneur.com, to see everything that's going on with the podcast and subscribe to our newsletter so that you can stay in the know and be the first on your block, so to speak, to gain insight into what's going on here. So once again, thanks for being here this time around. I appreciate your listenership. Hope to see you again next week on The Law Entrepreneur.